You're listening to the Mind Made Wrong podcast, presented by Steel Maggie, episode number 43. Hello, beautiful creators. I am Steel Maggie, and you are listening to the Mind Made Wrong podcast. This episode, we are joined by Martin. Say hello.
What's up? What's up? It's good to be here.
This is going to be an awesome interview. Thank you for joining me today in my crazy hairness. And for those of you on the audio streaming platforms, in part two, when it is released next week, we will be on video for you, and you'll get to see this crazy 90s haircut that I'm sporting, and it's absolutely ridiculous, but it's awesome, and I'm going to go with it, and I'm going to rock with it. Okay, so let's enough of me, although I could talk about myself all day. Let's talk about Martin, because Martin is one of the dopest motherfuckers on this planet. I love him. So tell us where we can find you, first of all, because a lot of times, you know, we don't want to leave it towards the end of the podcast because sometimes people tune out. Don't tune out, guys. First and foremost, don't tune out. But we want to know right off the bat where we can find you on social media, you know, YouTube, if you have one, Spotify, where are you at?
So Martin, the Martin Gashiri Experience, GACHIRI. I'm on SoundCloud, Instagram. I have a YouTube page where I'm mostly doing like guitar covers. So that's more of a third party type of thing. But yeah, basically that's where you can find me.
Absolutely. Okay. Yep. I love it. It's MGX.
Yes.
MGX. Yes. The experience. Tell us, because you were telling me, tell everyone else, it has nothing to do with Jimi Hendrix, right?
Nothing. Yeah, you know what? I didn't realize this until very recently. Thanks to Disney Plus, I was watching Even Stevens, and there's an episode where he's in Lewis starts a band, and it's like this making the band type of episode is weird, and or behind the music or something like that. And he starts the Lewis Stevens Experience. And when I was watching this episode, I realized that has to be where I got it from, because it like triggered something in my head. And it was a very intense, what do you call it? Like deja vu type of thing. So sadly, it has nothing to do with Hendrix.
Yeah. You were driven. You were so driven to have that name. Yeah. I mean, like, it's good. It works. Like I was just watching Hillary Duff on Lizzie McGuire. I love Hillary. I know I just love Hillary Duff, but like I was watching Lizzie McGuire. And I was, oh my God, this show was so good. And I'm probably going to revisit the Lizzie McGuire movie like really like soon. I love that movie. Like when they go to Rome and oh my God. Most of the, it's very funny that like a lot of times, it's so crazy because Steel Nostalgia is all about, like 2000s music and like 2000s, like, you know, early 2000s culture. And like a lot of podcasts that I've been, a lot of guests, a lot of interviews that I've been starting have always started off talking about some kind of 2000s little tidbit. So I don't know.
I'm glad I could contribute.
Yeah, glad you could contribute. Okay, let's get into it. Tell us your origin story. Please tell us about how Martin came to be, how the experience came to be reality.
I love that question. So I don't really come from like a musical family. So, but I was raised around a lot of different types of music. Like my dad loves Bob Dylan and stuff like that. So, I think 10 or 11, 12, something like that, I saw Sum 41 on TV, and that's when I knew that I wanted to play guitar. That's like the first time something in me was like, I need to start doing this. And so I started taking lessons, and from there it was kind of me trying to become a metalhead. I thought that's where I was headed. And so yeah, it's like me in a house full of like non-metal participants, and I'm trying to be like a metal. And you know, when I started playing, my parents had me on an acoustic guitar because they weren't sure I was serious about it. So I'm trying to like play metal on an acoustic guitar in a house full of people who don't want to hear that kind of stuff. So it's kind of adversity from the top, you know, from the start. A lot of palm muting. Like, yeah, a lot of chugging. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's hysterical. I love it. Like, that's, oh my God, that's so funny. I love it. Keep going.
So yeah, it's as cringy as it sounds, but once I did it for, you know, about a year or two, I guess my parents, like, they could see I was really into it and that I was kind of serious about it. So I remember that my dad bought me a Epiphone and like a little like Marshall amp. And that was a very intense day because I could finally play, you know, Metallica songs and Sum 41 stuff and have it sound like it was supposed to. So that was a very important, you know, what do you call it? Like a very important moment, I guess, in that career was getting that electric guitar because it kind of opened up the whole world of possibilities for me. Yeah.
I love it. Okay. So you are in a band currently. You have two acts. You have you have.
The one I completely failed to mention. Yeah.
You have you and you have Mellolando, which we are both friends, pals with Bender, who is said frontman of said band. And tell us a little bit about Mello.
So Mellolando, I joined that band after I was in Muse, which is a Cal Poly club, which is for musicians across majors who want to get together and play cover songs. We would meet every week, and there were a lot of musicians I met there that I'm still, you know, in contact with. But basically, he was in a band made up of people from that club, and once a vacancy opened up in the guitar department,
which never happens,
right? he reached out to me, and that was kind of the first time that someone asked me, hey, like, would you like to be in my band? So that had a lot to do with me joining in the first place. And then when I heard the music, I'm like, okay, I can definitely get behind this. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's good. Let's talk about your musical style and let's talk about your lyrical themes. What do you write about? What it can be for both. I know because you have more of a collaborative, it's more of a collaborative aspect when it comes to Mellolando because there's like four people. Tell us a little bit about your artistry when it comes to both acts and how you kind of separate that.
Okay, so I'll just start off. As far as separating them, it's a lot easier to separate Mellolando because I'm not asked to contribute as much songwriting wise. So it kind of helps to feel as if I'm part of a team helping create someone else's vision for the most part. But even when I do, you know, contribute for Mellolando, it's very similar to my solo work as far as the lyrical content because it's typically about, you know, relationships and the feelings behind those, which I know sounds vague, but I mean, that covers pretty much 99% of music, right?
I mean, it can be. It's funny, I really don't write a lot about, I think I write about relationships when it comes to myself. I write about my relationship with myself. I have like, I can count the number of like love songs I've written on one hand. And that was because I did the 30-day challenge. So like something had to come out, you know?
No, but I like the way you said that though. A love song, because I would consider the stuff I'm writing to be like relationship music, but I wouldn't call it a love song. So I think I'm casting a pretty wide net when I say the feelings behind it, because when I think of relationships and kind of the drama behind it, a lot of it has to do with how I feel about myself, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like how you put that, because I would consider it relationship related because it stems from those type of things, or at adjacent. Least when I write. Yeah, adjacent. There you go. That's a good word for it. But yeah, I've written probably, yeah, very few like love songs, like I love this person or I love, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, slow jams or stuff like, I don't really.
It's not like, you know, like, it's not, you know, let's get it on Marvin Gaye. You
no
know,
hips moving.
No Al Green.
Not, oh. I'm trying to picture myself singing like Al Green. Yeah, none of that. I haven't really tried that. But, but yeah, relationship with myself.
That would be cool.
That's an idea. Something to put on the to-do list. Definitely. But yeah.
Al Green is not Motown, but he's got some influences, you know. I definitely came from out of that, you know, like, I think a lot of, you know, or like soul artists came, like, did have a lot of influences there. So you could do like Motown Martin.
Ooh. See, alliteration gets me. So you already, I'm sold already.
You got it. No, you have to do that now.
Yo, okay. You know, so what? I'm calling it now. That's like a three to five song project right there.
Yep. Motown Martin. I things start on this podcast that like I cannot control. So you gotta be ready.
It's funny though, because that was a big like influence before I started playing guitar. My parents had this CD collection that was like, Motown put out their, I think it was like their number one singles, and they would put them out by like era. So they had, you know, I don't know, 50s through 60s or whatever, and then 60s through 70s and 70s, 80s. My parents, I don't know which volume they had, but it had like the Temptations and Marvin Gaye. So that was stuff that I was listening to when I was maybe like 8 or 9. I don't know. It obviously didn't have like a direct influence as far as me writing like that, but it's just interesting that you brought that up. It's like it wasn't on accident.
I don't think a lot. Most things aren't on accident in general. I'm kind of going through that kind of. I was telling you earlier, like woo woo shit, but I don't really believe in accidents anymore. I'm not really sure what I believe, but it's not. I am. Yeah, this is not about me. I can quickly turn it around. So let's talk about when it comes to not just the lyrical influences, but your musical influences. Like, what kind of genres do you listen to that feed into your creativity and your output when it comes to the experience?
When it comes to the Martin Gashiri experience, I'm noticing as I look back, because, you know, it kind of in preparation for this, I started looking back at my SoundCloud, which goes back to maybe 2013. And I'm looking at what I was writing back then. And it's like, a lot of it is dictated by what I'm listening to at the time. You know what I mean? So the earlier stuff might have some more punk and ska influence. As I was, you know, still hanging on to that kind of Warped Tour phase of my life, which was very important to me. I never really was in a ska band, but I was really into Big D and the Kids Table. And I love the Aquabats, so I feel like there was remnants of that in the early stuff, not in so much as horn arrangements, but just in like, you know, skanky guitar and stuff like that. And as time went on, it was me trying to find my own voice in kind of this alternative sound, is that's the way I'll put it, because I love hip-hop, I love ska, I love metal, I love punk, but it's like, how do I make that stuff kind of work, you know what I mean? So acts that influenced me directly, I would say like Fishbone was huge for me, because I didn't realize you could be in a band that has, you know, that many sounds across, you know, one project and have that be okay. Another singer-songwriter, Cody Chestnut, was very influential to me. He was kind of this weirdo acoustic dude who wrote soul music. He's the kind of guy who would sing an Al Green type of song, but then he would also do a song that's maybe 90 seconds long that has, you know, an electronic drum kit and is like him rapping. It's just stuff like that where I was like, it made me realize it was okay to be kind of that off the cuff and that, you know, this is just what I'm feeling, I'm gonna do it. So as far as whatever style I do, that's kind of the overarching theme, the kind of focus is like, whatever I'm feeling, just do it and worry about it later.
Yeah, you were telling me that it kind of opened you up to what a song could be and what an artist could be and what it really kind of, the freedom that you actually have in creation and being a songwriter. Is that something, because that was obviously a long time ago, let's start to talk about how you create now and what are some of the struggles that you come across when it comes to songwriting, when it comes to being an artist.
So as far as creating, that's been a, the way I create, it has to vary because I get very stuck, you know, I get very set in my ways. And one piece of advice I got a long time ago was to change how you start writing, change how you approach it. So one thing I like to do is start with a song or start with a title or a phrase. There's some like generators I found online where you can just like generate a 3 to 4 word phrase. So I'll hear something or read something and it's like, how do I make sense of this? Or what do I think of when I read this? How would I make sense of it? How would I convey it? So it becomes kind of like a challenge type of thing. Ooh. So as far as struggles, I would say tying into that, I think the biggest struggle is just like a self-esteem type of thing. Because I kind of have to coax, I have to like trick myself almost into writing certain things, because if someone were to ask me to do something straight off, I'd be like, oh no, that would be lame or no one would want to hear it. It'd be that kind of thing. So I have to like go about it in weird ways. And there have been a lot of my favorite songs have been written through looking at a song title or hearing a drum loop and just going off of that, you know. So yeah, I kind of just have to switch it up and, you know, see what works, because otherwise I get too bored with myself. And that's kind of the worst place to be as a creative.
It's okay. Absolutely. Do you think that, as you mentioned, self-esteem, and that's something that I think most, if not like every single artist or someone who considers themselves even remotely creative suffers with, is my work enough? You know, do I, you know, if there's an imposter syndrome. And as we get to start to talk a little bit more about the mental health and mindset aspects of this in this episode, I want to hear about your journey, you know, when it comes to self-esteem and self-worth. It's a big topic with me, because I've got, you know, my single coming out, and it's going to be out by the time this episode is going.
Yes, yes.
But it's a big topic for me, and I'm noticing that it's a big topic for a lot of people and for a lot of my guests. Mm. So with that said, let's talk about a time when in your life when you felt, keeping in the theme with this podcast, that either your mind was made wrong or you had a major crisis of self-esteem, self-worth. Mm. Let's talk about that time.
So as like when I hear that question, the first thing I think of is where I was right after high school. You know, it's weird because when I think back to when I was graduating, like I gave a speech at my high school graduation. I had like a lot of friends. I felt like a pretty charismatic person, but like inside I was just extremely, like, just, I don't know how to put it. Like, I just didn't believe in myself at all, but it's like, it didn't seem to correspond with what was going on around me. So when I went to college, I started at Cal Poly, and I felt like I was kind of just throwing myself into that situation because it was what I was supposed to do. So I'm kind of in this new environment as far as like how, you know, classes work and stuff like that. I was living on campus. So I was kind of throwing myself into this in completely new context of life. And I didn't have an idea of who I was in the last one. You know what I mean? So it was kind of this perfect storm for a, you know, like a breakdown. I don't know how else to put it. I kind of had to take a time out from life. And it ended up lasting maybe like a year and a half to 2 years where I wasn't in school. I wasn't really doing much. I spent a lot of time alone. And that's where I was forced to really confront myself. So I consider that to be like my, I don't know how to put it, like training ground for my self-esteem and my, you know, current mental state. It's like, if it wasn't going to happen there, it wasn't going to happen at all. So, that's really where I had to learn to be okay with who I was. And in certain contexts, I had to learn to improve myself. You know, one thing I don't think it's talked about too often is like the physical health aspect of, you know, depression and mental health. Because I know a lot of it for me, as soon as I started like working out more and trying to lose weight and just doing more cardio and stuff like that, there's no way that didn't have a direct effect on, you know, my daily mood and my outlook. It gave me like something to look forward to. So that was another big part of that.
What did that, I love it. What did that look like for you in that time? How were you living, you know, when you took that break from life, as you said, what did that look like for you when it came to your daily emotions and how you related with other people?
So most days I was just like in my bedroom, like all day. So as far as, it's just funny you say like relating to other people, I guess the closest I got to that was through the internet. You know, I was just trying to communicate with people through forums and stuff like that. But I felt like for the most part, I wasn't relating to other people on any kind of level. And it had pros and cons. Like I said, I was forced to confront myself, but the obvious con is that it kind of detracts from your ability to socialize with people. So it definitely was there was like a downside to that, but it was kind of like taking the good with the bad, you know, as far as that's how I feel when I look back on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was just a lot of time alone.
A lot of time in isolation.
Yeah.
That makes me think of something that we were talking about in our preliminary call when you were telling me about how just in your family and with the way things were at home, and you know, through no fault of really anyone's, it was difficult for you to express how you were actually feeling and your actual thoughts on things. And that's kind of translated into, you know, you're still in life, you know, still today. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how you're dealing with that now?
So there was just like some, like, how do I put it? Like family turmoil kind of at the time. And there are a lot of instances where I was having to think, okay, am I better off expressing this or just staying quiet for fear of like causing drama or upsetting somebody or this or that? So I found myself, you know, biting my tongue about a lot of things. And like I said, that carried over into after that, where during that time I told you, like, there was a time where I spent 2 weeks without talking to anybody, without saying anything out loud. And yeah. On one hand, I'm like, okay, maybe I talk too much. Like, that was a legit thing I was thinking afterward. Maybe I talk too much and this is a way to like keep perspective on that. But on the other hand, it kind of carried over for a while where it's like, I got so used to not saying things that it's kind of like you start to second guess yourself sometimes. So as far as now, that what it means is that if I have to make sure I really believe in something and like, that I really believe in something before I express it. So what that means is that the things I say to other people tend to carry more weight to them because they know if I'm going out of my way to express it, then it actually means something. And it's gone a long way into helping me like stop taking things personally or overthinking certain things. You know, it's easy to have an interaction with somebody and take away that they looked at you or something they said at you and spend the rest of your day agonizing over it. But when I went that long without saying something, I was thinking like, I wonder how many times that happens where it's just like someone doesn't realize that they did something to you. You know what I mean? You might be mad about something and they have no idea that they even slighted you. So, again, it has like pros and cons. I try to look at the more positive side of that nowadays. Which means that like my words carry a lot more weight with the people who hear them.
Do you think it's crazy because I don't shut up and I'm sitting here like 2 weeks without speaking. And you really like, you don't like, there's so many times when we take things personally and, I think that really, you know, there are things that need to be said, right. And there are things to be expressed. Do you think that, I'm still thinking about it. 2 weeks. I'm still like, you told me this in the preliminary call, and then I was like reminded, like, oh my God, that's insane. Do you think that, was that like an experiment, or it just happened? Like, you just didn't speak?
I guess it was a bit of both, because it started off as just something that just happened. Like, I went maybe 2 days without talking to anybody. And at first it was a very, very sad realization. It was very like, you know, like beating myself up, like, damn, mm-hmm. like I went 2 days without saying anything, and like, nobody reached, you know, it's like you start thinking about the,
no one reached out to me, no one loves me.
Yeah,
no.
You start thinking about the, you know, in that way. But then after a few days, I think what helped me from going too far down in that direction is I went, okay, let me see how long I can go, you know, without saying anything, and just see what happens. Like, it was, I was at a point in life where it's just like, let me just see what happens if I do this. And instead of doing something like interesting, like drugs or whatever, I was like, let me just not talk. I don't know. Like, some people do more stuff. I didn't go to a party or something, or have some like weird experience. I was just like, let me just try not to talk. Which I think, I mean, compared to where I was like in high school and before that, like I used to talk a lot. So I felt like it was kind of like two different extremes for me. That's why it's hard for me to like tell anyone to try that. Like, it's not, I wouldn't recommend it. Yeah.
It's not a mental health tip that you would
not no.
recommend.
Yeah. No. Do not try it.
Did you feel like after that you were able, you kind of knew yourself better? I kind of want to talk about how you got out of that hole, and some more of the specifics of baby techniques that you used, or how did you overcome that deep depression?
So
that really kind of caused you to to not speak for 2 weeks, you know?
I'd say the biggest thing was, as far as starting to get out of that, was reaching out to the people around me. It's really weird, because I had immediate family available to me in a lot of this, like during a lot of that, like time, that year and a half or 2 year period. But I was kind of choosing to isolate myself from them. So once I started reaching out to them, they were a lot, how do I put it? They were like eager to kind of figure out what had been going on. Like, I remember talking to my mom, and I went to go visit her, and she started talking to me, and that was like the first conversation I'd had in that like 2 week period. And then after, when I told her about it, she's looking at me like, what the hell's wrong with you? Like, why didn't you just like come by? But she also knew like what that meant. She knew that it wasn't just me like feeling down or something, that there was like something else going on. So again, like just reaching out to people, like, you'd be surprised. It feels like when you feel like you're most a burden, like that's probably the most that someone wants to hear from you. You know what I mean? When you really feel like you're a burden, it's weird. Like, it tends to be, that's when people like are most eager to like help you, you know?
I sense it. I think, you know, Wow. Okay. That's my quote. Like, when you are feeling like the most, like you're a burden, and you know, like you're, you know, a disease to society or whatever, that's when like people really, like, that's when you can benefit obviously the most from it. And that's when I think others can also benefit the most from it. So that's a really good, that's a great mental health tip. Thank you, Martin. Amazing. Yes. What would you say to those of us who hate talking to people? Even though I love to talk. Yeah. Like,
see, that's rough. That's rough. Cause
I can't stop talking, but I don't like to, like, I think it's like a humility thing. It's like an ego thing. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I actually am struggling, you know?
So I don't know. It's like, when that kind of ties into the whole, you know, creative aspect of things, because when I wasn't talking to other people, when I was kind of forced to confront myself, it was coming out in the form of like lyrics or in a guitar riff. I used to write these kind of like instrumental guitar pieces. I don't know what else to call them. But that was kind of my idea of expressing what was on my mind, you know, this kind of a beyond words type of thing. And so I was able to find something to latch on to express myself. So if someone doesn't like to talk, I would draw something, paint something, I don't know, like write a letter. I know. Ooh. Like something to, there are other ways. There's gotta be something out there for everybody to latch on to that can help them get that energy out. You know what I mean? Get mm-hmm. that emotion out.
Mm-hmm. Or help them experience community in a way that is not, you know, too foreign to them. Mm. Or some, even just like community when it comes to just being in connection with yourself and with, mm. you know, whatever you believe to be the universe or God or anything. I think it's when we get so isolated, you know, yeah. in all ways of thinking that it's like, it's me, myself, and I, you know, it's selfishness without realizing that it's selfishness. Mm. I think, and that's what, you know, depression does, is that, you know, my mom is a therapist and she's always like, depression is a liar. And I'm like, yeah, mom, I know. And, but she's so right, you know, and, it's an isolator. Mm. And, so I really like that you can do, many different things, that doesn't have to be necessarily talking to someone on the phone.